Welcome to the beginning of the weekend. Happy Friday to you. I hope you're all looking forward to doing something special with the people you love. Don't forget to go and be part of your home congregation. You need to worship and fellowship and study and pray and praise and be able to serve and encourage with that family of Jesus Christ that you call home. If you don't have a place like that, you need to go out and find it. And then you get plugged in, stay plugged in. And of course, if you are actively looking for a place right now, we invite you to come to Elkhart East and see whether or not we might be the place where you will fit in. I want to thank everyone that is helping keep this program going out over the radio waves. We can't do this without that sort of support. So if there's anyone out there that would like to help, just write down the contact information you'll hear at the end of today's broadcast. Then you can send your one-time or ongoing gift of any amount to that address, and it will go for that specific purpose. We were telling the climactic part of the story of Joseph last time, at least the climactic part of him getting out of prison and becoming the second in command in Egypt. We're in Genesis chapter 41, verse 37. He's just explained to Pharaoh what the meaning of his two dreams are. There's going to be seven spectacularly prosperous agricultural years, followed by seven shockingly, dramatically disastrous famine years. And so he goes from there with the prompting of the Holy Spirit to recommend an action. He tells Pharaoh, what you really ought to do is find somebody that's good at administering and have them collect 20% of every good year's produce and put it into storage all over Egypt. And then you'll have what it's going to take to get through those next seven bad years. And so verse 37 says, this proposal pleased Pharaoh and all his servants. And Pharaoh said to his servants, can we, you know, as a ruling group, as a ruling council, find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God? Are we going to find a better candidate for this responsibility of chief administrator of the kingdom than this guy? Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house. And he's not talking just about his personal residence. He's talking about the house of Egypt. And all my people shall order themselves as you command. Only in regards the throne will I be greater than you. Now, Pharaoh was basically the chief ruler of a group of rulers in Lower Egypt. Lower Egypt is the delta plus part of the river of Egypt feeding into the delta. And so he has to run a kingdom that is made up of different areas, different regions with different leaders there. And so he says, you're going to become the vizier. Now, vizier is not the Egyptian word. I can't remember what the Egyptian word is off the top of my head. But the vizier was the chief administrative officer of the kingdom. He had nothing to do with the military. He doesn't do anything to do with international policies or anything like that. He is completely focused on the economy to keep everyone functioning and healthy as a people group. And so that's the job that he's being given, and Pharaoh will be taking care of all the other things. So Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And the Pharaoh took his signet ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand. And he clothed him in garments of fine linen, put a gold chain about his neck. Now, don't think of a single strand chain. You probably ought to think of what you see in the Egyptian portrayals of this time period. It is like a golden collar that high administrative officials wore. Now, he only wears like a little white kilt. Now, this is a fancy one. This is his high grade, probably high thread count linen that he's wearing. So he is going to look very Egyptian from here on out. And that's how he's going to be seen by his brothers when they show up. Verse 43, he made him ride in his second chariot. You know, terminology doesn't change much over the years. You know, you have Air Force One. That's any aircraft that the President of the United States rides on. Marine One is any helicopter that the President rides on. But Air Force Two, Marine Two, that's anything that the Vice President is on. Okay, that's the situation here. He gets Chariot Two. And it's not he drives himself around. He's going to be chauffeured everywhere and have a bodyguard that goes with him. And they called out before him, bow the knee, or, you know, kneel down, show your respect. So he is treated as the high official he now is. And thus he set him over all the land of Egypt. And when he does say all the land of Egypt, we're talking about all of the Nile and a good section of the river feeding into the Nile. So Pharaoh then said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh. Without your consent, no one shall lift up hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. A clear idiom of nobody's going to do a thing without you approving of it, directing it. And then he changes his name from its Hebrew, which is Yosef, which means to be added to, and because he's now an Egyptian official, he needs an Egyptian name. So he called his name Zaphnath-Paaneah, and no one knows for sure exactly what this Egyptian name means. There's some really good guesses. I've got a footnote that I'm looking at in another Bible that I've got open here. It's a New American Standard, and it says, God speaks, he lives. But I've also seen others that say something along the lines of, what he says must be done. And I think that sounds pretty interesting. Sounds like a sort of name meaning that Pharaoh would give to him at this time. If he says it, you better do it. Okay, so on to the next. He gave him in marriage Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. Now, On is a close English approximation of the Hebrew, which is a close approximation of the Egyptian, On, which represents a town right there in the Delta. I think it's on the most eastern stream of the Nile when it splits into seven streams going toward the Mediterranean. We may find it easier to remember it by its Greek name many, many centuries later, Heliopolis, which is actually a representation in the Greek language of what the meaning of the name is in Egyptian. It's the city of the sun. So this guy, Potipherah, appears to be a priest of the sun god, which we know by the name Re or Ra. And that whole city was devoted to his worship of bringing energy to the people of Egypt. Now, why does the Pharaoh marry him off to the daughter of a priest? Well, the Pharaoh is a polytheist. He believes in multiple gods. And so in his mind, Joseph is tied in to a very powerful god who can interpret dreams, give dreams. And so he ought to be married into the religious community. So Joseph really doesn't have a choice in this matter. He has, for all practical purposes, just been adopted by the Pharaoh. And what the father of the family says when it comes to marriage arrangements goes. So he gets married to Aseneth, who is the daughter of a sun-worshipping priest. And I am always curious as to how long it might have taken before Joseph converted his wife and possibly his father-in-law to quit believing in the sun god Ra and the multiple gods of the Egyptians and to believe in the one true God. Now, there's nothing in the text to bear that out. That's my hope. That's my imagination playing out what I'd love to be true. I look forward to one of these days in the eternal kingdom of sitting down and listening in as Joseph tells more of his story to those of us that are wanting to hear it and finding out just exactly what happened to him and his wife. Now, verse 46. First of all, Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. That's the end of verse 45. You should picture him riding in his chauffeur chariot number 2, everywhere, up and down the Nile River, and down each of the 7 streams in the delta, visiting every community, visiting every storehouse that was being built, visiting every storehouse after it had been built, making sure every administration is in place, all the people to keep records. So he is a busy man everywhere in the kingdom, trying to make sure that the good years are not wasted. So verse 46 is what helps us with our chronology. It says, Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So he would have been 30 in 1895 going into 94 BC. His granddad died the previous year. And so as Joseph is coming to power, his father is continuing to grieve over losses in his life. Just a little part of the humanity involved in the story here. So Joseph was 30 years old when he entered the service of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. Again, every day he's traveling somewhere to make sure everything is taking place the way it's supposed to. During the 7 plentiful years, the earth produced abundantly. And he gathered up all the food of these 7 years, which occurred in the land of Egypt, and put the food in the cities. He put in every city the food from the fields around it. Now, if Joseph hadn't been there, it is likely that people would have celebrated a superabundant year and would have probably come up with some plan to sell their excess off somewhere else. Now, I don't know right off the top of my head exactly how much contact the kingdom of Egypt had already with other Mediterranean civilizations of this time period. I do know that in later time periods, such as the Roman period, Egypt was the breadbasket of the city of Rome. The city of Rome could not grow enough food to feed itself simply on the continent, on the peninsula of Italy. They needed to supplement heavily from the bounty of the grains of Egypt. And they had grain ships running back and forth between Egypt and Italy all the time in the first century. So my suspicion is that if Joseph had not been around, revealing that this was going to be 7 years followed by seven bad years, they probably would have sold off all their excess. And when the 7 years hit, they would have been in big trouble. So instead, they are laying in a superabundant storage of their surplus. So Joseph stored up grain in great abundance, like the sand of the sea. That's an idiom we've seen elsewhere. It means it was so much, you wouldn't really even want to try to count it. Which, interestingly enough, it says next. It says, until he ceased to measure it, for it could not be measured. Now, the Egyptians were big in administration. You can find evidence of them keeping administrative records about everything, including how much harvest, how many gallons of olive oil, or whatever it was that they were counting. They had ways of counting. They came up, they developed numbers of very large quantities. I think millions was included into their accounting purposes. And so here we are told at some point it went beyond the capability of all their scribes to keep track of. It was just so much, which is a good thing because they're supposed to be making sure that the seven famine years will be survivable by the Egyptian people. Now, the Egyptian people do have one advantage that does not happen in Canaan. The river Egypt, the river of Egypt, that is the Nile, is not going to just simply dry up. It's just not going to flood like it usually does. It might get smaller, but the river will still be there as a water source. And so much of Egypt will still be able to use ingenious forms of irrigation to plant a limited crop for each of the 7 years of the famine and be able to harvest some of that. In the land of Canaan, that's not going to be possible. Because when their wadis don't get their winter rains, they're going to be totally dry. The water table will start dropping. You can't really dig a well deep enough if the water table has dropped precipitously. So you can't really irrigate. That's why Abraham took off for Egypt because of the problem of when a drought hits in the Middle East, the lower Middle East, what we call the Holy Land. And so what's going to happen, which we already know is going to happen, is that Egypt will have more than enough to get through the seven bad years. So they will be able to responsibly sell to other countries, to other people groups that are coming out of their own dire needs. Okay? So that's where we're going next. Now, verse 50. Before the year of famine came, so in that 7 year period of Bounty. So we're talking about 1894, because the Joseph came probably during the planting time. He came into power in some sort of association with the planting time of fall and winter of 1895. So the harvest time would have been 1894. So somewhere between 1894 and 1888, during that 7 years of storing up really good harvests, this happened. Two sons were born to Joseph. Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, the priest of On, bore them to him. So he started a family in his 30s, early 30s. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh. Now, in Hebrew, Manasseh is the verbal form of being caused to forget, which is why Joseph says, "For," he said, "God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house." So when he lifts up that baby boy and looks into his eyes, and on the eighth day of his life, he personally circumcises him for, and I'm sure he did, because he is very much a God server. He is a righteous person. And so he would follow the covenant requirements of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, of circumcision on the eighth day. So when that eighth day comes around and he is naming him, he says, "You know what? I have been through some rough times with what my brothers did to me, with what Mrs. Potiphar did to me, with what the things that happened to me in the prison, including being forgotten at first. I am so thankful now that I'm married and in very high leadership in Egypt, well-respected. I am so thankful that God is making me forget all the bad times." So that's the meaning of Manasseh's name. You will notice, and maybe you never thought about this, Joseph does not make any attempt to go back home now that he is powerful. He has decided this is his country. This is his life. And all that stuff in the past is to be forgotten. Verse number 52. The name of the second he called Ephraim. Ephraim is the idea of doubly blessed or doubly fruited. And so he says, "For God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction." So son number two gets a name that has a dual ending, a pairing ending, a number two ending. I am doubly fruited now. I have two boys because God has made me bear fruit in a land where I once was on the down and out. I was once afflicted. So he clearly, from this naming of his two sons, is fully focused on Egypt. Egypt is his home. Egypt is his job. Egypt is his mission. Verse 53. The 7 years of plenty that occurred in the land of Egypt came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. And there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So we have come now to 1887, the spring of 1887. Now that means that the winter rains in Canaan didn't come in the winter of 1887. Not a drop. And they already know they're in trouble because they need those early rains and the later rains in order to make their crop germinate and grow and put on fruit. That didn't come. So when the spring of 1887 comes, they know they're in trouble. They have no harvest, and whatever seed stock they might have already had from the previous years is not going to be sufficient to feed them all. They need to plant for the fall for next year. They don't realize it's going to be a famine again. So they've got a certain amount that's set aside for seed stock, but they need enough to get through until the following spring, an entire year later. And so they are in trouble. Now, verse 55 says, when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread, and Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, well, you go to Joseph. What he says to you, do. Now, interestingly enough, some of the people in Egypt did not prepare personally. They should have. You know, not everybody works for Pharaoh. Some of them are individual farms. And evidently they had 7 good years and they didn't keep anything on hand. Must have sold some of it. And so they get hungry and they come crying to the king. And Pharaoh says, you need to go and check in with Joseph. Verse 56. So when the famine had spread over all the land, Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, for the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. Now, so this is the beginning of a process we'll read about later, where there is a transfer of value or wealth into the coffers of the kingdom. Verse 57, this sets us up for next week. Moreover, all the earth came to Egypt to Joseph to buy grain, because the famine was severe over all the earth.